It's no secret that there are a lot of divisions in American culture and politics these days. Urban and rural, red state and blue state, black and white, north and south, no matter how you slice it, there are big groups of people who don't know each other, don't understand each other, and maybe don't like each other. Wisconsin is no exception. Research by the state's own Kathy Kramer shows a big divide between rural Wisconsin and the two biggest cities, Milwaukee and Madison. But there are efforts to close these gaps. Last week, we heard about a UW Green Bay program that took students on cultural outings to meet people from different backgrounds. And there are longer-term programs in the U.S. that let students live in a different part of the country, like an international student exchange program, but not international. Our next guest says we need to see a lot more of those exchanges to help different communities understand one another. Amanda Ripley wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal. She's a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective and the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into these exchange programs, from where you're sitting, how bad are these divisions I was just talking about?
It's kind of frightening, actually. I mean, the more research that I look at, the more unsustainable it feels. You know, we haven't seen these level of divisions in recent memory. You know, right now in experiments with thousands of Americans, researchers have found that partisan animosity exceeds racial hostility. You know, a third of Democrats and half of Republicans say they'd be upset if their kids married someone from the other party. That's way up from past surveys asking the same question going back to the 60s. So the problem is there's really only two ways to get out of this kind of tribalism, according to the research into, you know, human behavior and psychology. And the two ways are either to have a new common enemy, to go to war against someone else, which isn't great, obviously, or to interact more with each other, to have human interactions that are not hostile, and to see that we are not, none of us is just one thing. We are all many things, and we can't be reduced to stereotypes, but it is, you know, obviously a longstanding human weakness to be tribal and to demonize others. And right now we are in a real spiral. So we know that if we could get more people talking from different parts of the country, from different viewpoints, we know if it were done in a way that was friendly and not scary, that we could chip away at some of this. But right now, it's just not naturally happening. People are more geographically segregated than ever before. So you don't encounter people through the draft or through your job or through other things that used to help mitigate against some of that tribalism.
So why exchange programs? Why do you see that as a valuable part of the solution?
Well, you know, I used to write about students in other countries, and it was really valuable to sort of follow kids, American teenagers, to other countries and see what they saw through their eyes in different schools and neighborhoods around the world. And the reason those exchange programs were all started was in order to avoid exactly the kind of demonization that we're seeing. You know, the theory was one of the biggest ones called the American Field Service, which used to be a volunteer ambulance corps, actually, and they did a lot of brutal tours in Europe during World War One and World War Two. And after evacuating a concentration camp in Germany after World War Two, they decided to become an exchange program instead to try to prevent the kind of conflict that they were seeing. So starting in 1947, 53 kids from 11 nationalities came to the U.S. and France to study and live for 1 year among foreigners. And it just grew and grew and grew. And then in the 60s, you started seeing AFS, the same organization, and others start up exchanges within, in the 70s in particular, within the U.S. So what you started to realize is through the civil rights protests, anti-Vietnam protests, there was obviously a lot of tension then, too, in the country. And it looked like, you know, for a variety of reasons, it might be valuable to get Americans to other parts of America for the very same reasons. So we know that, you know, hundreds of students have done these over the years. They kind of faded away, some of them, in the 1980s, but some of them still exist through other organizations. AFS is mostly now international exchanges, but they're looking at reviving the domestic exchanges for these very reasons.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley about exchange programs, not just international ones, but getting people from different communities in the United States to go and live with a different community in hopes of bridging political divides, cultural divides, urban-rural divides, and more. So, Amanda, you looked at some of these currently existing programs. Can you talk about some of the exchanges that are going on right now that bring together people from different parts of the U.S.?
Sure. So there's an exchange, for example, that Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island still does and has done for many years with Tougaloo College, a historically black college near Jackson, Mississippi. So every year they send students in both directions. More than 500 students and faculty have participated in the exchange over the past 50 years. And the thing is, they stay past the point of discomfort, right? Like, it's not just a weekend or a day or a conference. They stay for a semester. And they really have to push through and forge some relationships. And it's difficult. It's difficult for both sides. It's really interesting talking to the students who had gone from Tougaloo to Brown and vice versa, the faculty as well. You know, there were students who had gone from Brown University to Amsterdam on exchange before in the Netherlands who found going to Tougaloo to be much more bewildering and disorienting. So there was a lot of, for everyone, to learn on both sides, and often the students end up teaching, the exchange students end up teaching their hosts as much as the hosts teach the exchange students, which is exactly the same as how it works internationally. So, for example, you know, I talked with a student who had grown up in Texas and Mississippi before spending a semester at Brown in the spring of 2015, and she found right away she really missed the Southern hospitality, you know, the way everyone would say hi on campus without fail. People in Brown seemed kind of cold and unwelcoming. And she did a presentation to her class about this and explaining why she valued Southern hospitality. And, you know, after that, everyone in that class would say hello to her without fail when she saw them on campus. So there's challenges on both sides. But in the end, she ended up applying to Brown to med school, and she still finds herself playing the role of, you know, cultural ambassador, having to explain the South to doctors in training at Brown, which is incredibly valuable, right, for those students.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing reading what you wrote about people who did these exchanges in the United States, for all intents and purposes, going to a different part of the country, in some cases maybe even a different part of a state, can be like going to a foreign country.
It sounds crazy, right, because we speak the same language in theory. But in fact, maybe because our expectations are that it won't be that different, the differences can be quite striking. It's the food, it's religion, it's the sort of norms around socializing. And, you know, one of the things that the students who go from Brown to Tougaloo notice is how integrated Christianity is into everything that happens at the school. You know, no meetings start without a Christian prayer. And this is something that if you don't understand that, you know, if you can't respect that on some level, you know, you're going to have a hard time fitting in this place. You don't have to be Christian, but you have to respect this ritual, right? And often what you find for the students going to the Northeast is that sometimes people, including professors, are sort of casually dismissive of Christianity in particular, in ways that are very patronizing. So, you know, there's a lot there and there's a lot of value, but it takes human interactions. You know, you have to eat a meal together. You have to talk to one another. And it's not the kind of interactions that we get online right now, unfortunately.
Well, I wonder, though, you know, people in the small southern town and the big northeastern city, say, might have stereotypes about each other. But when they go from one place to another, do they get past the stereotypes? Or isn't it possible that they can confirm their negative perceptions of each other in person?
That's a really good point. And you see that with the international exchanges, too. There's been a lot of research on this and the kind of predictable phases that people go through when they live in another country. You know, there's usually a phase of euphoria where you think it's amazing and you can't get over the croissants and whatever. But then over time, you feel kind of alienated. You miss being home. You might resent your host. So and you have to get to the other side of that, right? So you're right. You want to do this carefully, and you want to do it in ways where you're mindful of the risk of leaving people more alienated. But in general, I don't think that's, from the people I've talked to, that doesn't tend to be what happens. That over time, look, you know, one of the great strengths of Americans, and I say this, you know, having had the privilege of living in many places, Americans are ultimately pretty good one-on-one. Like, we're pretty friendly. Like, not always. We have plenty of problems, but Americans are not as hard of a culture to break through, generalizing wildly here, but as other countries. So what I found is that, you know, when you have these kinds of interactions, if they're authentic, right, they have to be meaningful, and they have to be sustained. What you find is that people begin to respect the complexity of each other, and it makes it much, much harder to reduce each other down to a stereotype or a monster or whatever we may be doing now.
Amanda Ripley is with us. We're talking about cultural exchange programs. She says we need more of them within the United States to help bridge political and cultural divides. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Do you think it is a good idea? Have you participated in some kind of exchange program within the U.S. or internationally, maybe through a school, a university, or a group like Rotary? What was that experience like for you? Did it change the way you thought about other people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amanda Ripley. She says we need more exchange programs within the United States so people can understand different people and communities around the country and maybe overcome some of the nation's cultural and political divides and some of the stereotypes that go along with them. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Have you done something like this, some kind of exchange within the U.S. or other countries, maybe been a host family here in the United States? How did it change your life? Do you think it is a recipe for getting people of different perspectives together and making them understand each other a little better? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Brandon is with us in Oshkosh. Brandon, hi.
Yeah, hey there. So I just wanted to ask the guest. I had a friend who's an English teacher in Milwaukee tell me that in America, for social studies, he's a social studies teacher, not an English teacher, I apologize, that we use two textbooks. And in the South, they're basically taught that the Civil War is about Northern aggression. And in the North, we're taught that it's mostly about the abolishment of slavery. So if that's true, I was just curious what the guest has to say about that, and because it seems like a systemic problem from the very beginning of our life.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Amanda, we're maybe not just brought up in different ways, but taught in different ways, and depending on where we grew up in the country, and can we bridge that?
Absolutely. That's a really good point that Brandon makes, and it's one you hear. You know who I hear this from the most is actually children of military families, because they naturally do this. They move all over the country, and they get very different curricula from place to place, and they are very hip to this problem. They find, you know, math is really hard in, you know, Maryland and super easy in Georgia, depending on where they are. And they see huge differences culturally, also, you know, the sort of bias and slant that you get from place to place, but also the level of rigor. So that's something that students are particularly well positioned to see. So teachers, you know, it's not hard to imagine doing an exchange program like this targeting teachers. There are international exchange programs for American teachers and for teachers from other countries, because they are the ones, obviously, as Brandon's pointing out, that sort of start from a very early age this skew one way or another, or, you know, hopefully help us create a little bit more understanding and empathy across divides. So that would be another way to do this. And it's interesting, since I did this piece for the Wall Street Journal, I've heard from a variety of groups that are trying to do exchanges in new ways that use technology to help us talk across partisan divisions. Maybe, you know, you sign up, there's the American Dialogue Project, where you sign up online and you give just a little bit of information about yourself, and they match you with someone who's very different from you, and you have a 40-minute phone call that's facilitated by a professional moderator. And then there's other ones that use FaceTime, and there's other ones where you meet at a coffee shop and Starbucks will pay for your coffee and that sort of thing. So there's different ways to do this. Those are more kind of one-off, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, they don't last for a year or 3 months like exchange programs have. But it's the same kind of concept, and I think it's worth watching and seeing which of these can really take off and involve more and more people.
Who would need to take the lead in order to make these more lengthy exchanges where, you know, a student maybe goes and lives with a host family for months at a time, who needs to take that lead to bring that back and make it more of a reality?
Well, I think that the existing exchange programs would be a really good place to start. You mentioned Rotary programs. They run some amazing exchanges all over the world, and they're obviously located all over the country. So that would be a good one. AFS, which still exists and, again, is looking into trying to figure out a way to revive domestic exchange programs. In some ways, it's an easier sell for people because it tends to be a little cheaper than going to another country. Parents who might be nervous about their kids going abroad are a little less nervous about them going to Florida. So, you know, there is some opportunity here, particularly as families are more and more sort of stressed about studying abroad in college because of the expense. There is an opportunity, if it's done mindfully and carefully, to really bring people from other countries, from other states, sorry, through the U.S. as if it's multiple countries, which in some ways, you know, it is.
Let's go to another caller now. We've got Lucy with us in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I was involved in an exchange program called Project Self-Help and Awareness. It was the Wisconsin-Mississippi exchange program started during the Civil Rights Movement by a white lawyer from Wisconsin and a law student, I believe it was, and a black woman from Mississippi. And they would take trips down the Mississippi and stay with black people in Mississippi, and they would do bus trips for kids from Mississippi to come up and stay with families in Wisconsin. And it was usually more rural areas, families. For a couple of weeks, the kids would stay, so there would be this experience of a very different setting. And I went down there in, I think, the 80s and the 90s, my memory is not so great. On some of these bus trips, to help chaperone kids on the bus and help drive the bus sometimes. And we would stay with families for a day or two. And my experience of it was that I really did feel like I was in a different country. But it was kind of amazing because the black families that hosted us down there were just so welcoming and kind and warm. It just felt like we were... We were coming to a very strange place and being welcomed in warmly, but at the same time, we also got some experience of what the apartheid kind of racism was there.
Lucy, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And Amanda, you were talking about that. That was something that was maybe more common for a couple decades there.
Yeah, and that's something that the people I interviewed who, like Lucy, had been on these programs really were struck by, was the warmth with which they were greeted. You know, you go with a lot of apprehension about what New York or Wisconsin or Illinois is like, and when you're greeted warmly, you can, you know, there's a lot of relief that comes with that, and a lot of open-mindedness. You know, when you share a meal with someone, when you hear their story, you don't have to agree, you won't agree on everything, but it just, that human interaction is so critical. We know from, you know, Jonathan Haidt did a great book called The Righteous Mind a few years ago, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And one of the things that he articulates very well is that, you know, at a certain point, once you're kind of dug in on one side or the other on a political issue, it's impossible. No amount of facts is going to change your mind. That's just not the way the human brain works. The only way you will reconsider or modulate your position is through, you know, interactions with other human beings you kind of like. So that's really the only choice. And there is, Lucy's call reminded me of, there is an organization now called Better Angels that did a bus tour around July 4th this summer with a very similar goal and is doing some other interesting things. So there are people trying to figure this out, but it is, the challenge is kind of, you know, making sure people know about it and getting it to scale so that it involves millions instead of thousands of people.
Thanks for the call, Lucy. Time for another caller, Daniel in Milton. Daniel, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, do you have an experience to share?
Yeah, I'm close to 50. And back in 1985, I graduated high school half a year early, and I went to Israel for a year and a half. And part of what I did there was an exchange program. Well, it wasn't really an exchange program. It was just like a placement of foreign students. And I was placed with a Iraqi Jewish family in Jerusalem, whose their family had been sort of chased out of Iraq back in the 40s, And it was really an eye-opening experience because, you know, having come from a totally different environment, I was introduced to people who really didn't have that much in terms of material wealth. I was given the laundry room to sleep in, basically. And I got just to see how people lived in such a very different way, you know, how they respected their elders and how they handled neighbors. And it was a really wonderful eye-opening experience that also helped open my eyes to, you know, more of my own Jewish heritage.
Daniel, thank you so much for the call. He repeated a phrase three times there, eye-opening, Amanda. As we wrap up, that's what this does, isn't it?
You know, what I found when I've spent a lot of time with exchange students, and what's really striking is how at a certain point they just become more at peace with uncertainty. They become more flexible in the world. Like they can sort of like they've shrugged off a layer of assumptions and fears that holds us back from moving through the world and living a full life. And so that is something that I can't echo strongly enough and experience everyone should have one way or another, whether it's within the U.S. or outside of the U.S. If you have the chance, I would do it.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Amanda Ripley, senior fellow at the Emerson Collective and author of the book The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Her piece on cultural exchange programs appeared in the Wall Street Journal. We have that linked over at the Central Time Facebook page. And I'm still interested to hear from you if you have done an exchange program, if you've participated as maybe a student yourself or a host family. Tell us what you did, what organization you did it through, and most importantly, what it did for you. Did it change the way you looked at the world, the way you looked at people from a different culture? And as Amanda was saying, the way you deal with uncertainty and being in an unfamiliar environment. Again, read her article and share your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.